First, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me out here. It's been fun so far. I'm looking forward to talking to more of you. So as I was thinking about preparing this talk, I thought a little bit about trying to tell you about some of the data sets that we've been working on and some of our initial thoughts about statistical methods for analyzing these sort of large-scale data sets with an eye towards motivating and just sort of placing the questions in your minds, because I think there's just a tremendous need to bring in more and more classically trained and quantitatively trained scientists into the biological sciences. As we know, this is just sort of a growing area for fruitful collaboration. So as a way of motivation, just wanted to sort of raise the point that technological developments that have arisen relatively recently, I'd say in the last couple of years, have really dramatically driven down the cost of sequencing and genotyping. So today, it's feasible to score about 500,000 variable sites in the human genome for under $250 a sample. Right? They're not commercial companies that you can contract to go through and look at your genome and query regions that are known to be variable and compare those across individuals. And this has now led to dramatic increase in the sort of studies where you go through and you take patterns of genetic variation and try to correlate them with disease outcome. And so there are now large-scale projects underway in humans to do a lot of this. What may not be as appreciated is that this technology is now also making its way into almost every other system you can imagine, model, and otherwise. I mean, there are now these real barriers breaking down between what we think about as a traditional model system. So, for example, my lab works on dogs. And we have a large collaborative project to look at the genetic differences among domestic dog breeds, as well as to identify genes in different dog populations. We've also got a project on rice to develop the same kind of technology that gets used for humans, but to do rice improvement. We were part of the bovine HapMap project, which, again, tried to develop these sort of large-scale genomic resources. And so in the way that humans have always sort of led, where the technology first gets used in humans and then sort of filters on through, it is now very, very feasible to almost start to think of any system as a model system. And I like to say that, in the coming years, the first chapter of someone's PhD thesis is likely to be, well, I built the genome for the organism I'm interested in, chapter one. Chapter two, I built a SNP chip or something equivalent, and then I went through and did some interesting biology trying to correlate the phenotypes that I'm interested in with genetic variation. And it's really kind of daunting to think about that and to sort of tie it back into the real need to develop methods and algorithms and approaches to really make sense of all these data. So some of the questions that we're sort of classically interested in trying to identify include trying to quantify genetic differences within and among populations, the sort of bread and butter of population genetics, which now gets done at finer and finer scales. And I'll tell you a little bit about some of the work we've been doing at looking at closely related human populations and sort of the sort of surprising differences that we can really distinguish between even very closely related populations. As with most of genetics, we're interested in mapping genes for some traits and traits of interest. And so, for example, in humans, it's often disease susceptibility. And what has changed is that instead of focusing on highly penetrant, say, Mendelian disorders where you can look at families that are segregating and sort of map the genes, you're now starting to look at more and more complex traits where genes may only be playing a small role, but an important role. And so these sort of more complicated phenotypes have become amenable. In dogs, we're interested in morphology, so we're interested in body size variation, hair color, all kinds of phenotypes of interest. In rice, it's something like seed size or yield, and so on. So there's lots of traits, lots of genes, and the question is, how do we piece this all together? From my perspective, I got interested in these problems because I was fundamentally interested in evolution. And so one of the things that you can now begin to do is really reconstruct demographic history and detect targets of recent natural selection in a way we couldn't do even, I'd say, 5 years ago. And Ryan Guttenkunst, who's a postdoc in my lab, has done some, I think, really beautiful work on coming up with ways that you can bring in what may be very standard and computational approaches in physics, but really bridge them in and make important contributions to the way we model biological populations. And then one that is now sort of almost daily in the cover of the New York Times is this issue of personal genomics. So now we're no longer going through and correlating genetic variation with disease outcome, but now it becomes a question of, what does this tell me about my genome? How do I go online and make sense of my genetic variation? How do I internalize the information that I'm getting and make perhaps health-related decisions? And so it opens up this whole sort of social and ethical set of questions that for many are quite fascinating, but also quite daunting. And I mean, the point is that this is happening right now. This isn't something like, oh, in the future we'll have, no, it's now. The future's today. The data's there. By the end of this year, you can probably get your whole genome done, not just markers, and it becomes a real issue, right? How do you manage that information in a sense that makes sense to you, both as a scientist and then as non-scientist, when your friends and family begin to ask you, well, I've got this variant, what does that mean? What does that tell me? I mean, these are questions that you're really going to be asked to deal with. So I thought I'd tell you sort of about two seemingly unrelated but kind of related stories. One is about rhesus macaque, which is a monkey that gets used in AIDS research, and we've been doing a little bit of work on thinking about rhesus. And then the second is about worldwide patterns of human population variation. But to start, I just wanted to take a little bit of a step back and talk at a very broad level about disease gene mapping, how it sort of proceeds in most ways, and why the whole problem of population structure really is an important and interesting problem, aside from those of us who are interested in evolution and population genetics, but really from a very practical perspective in trying to understand signals in genetic data. So just as a form of sort of leveling the playing field, I just wanted to begin by thinking a little bit about what we mean by association mapping. I think of association mapping like pornography, right? You know, it's hard to define, but I know what it means to me, right? You know, everyone sort of has their own personal definition, so I'll give you my sort of definition of association mapping. So I would say that association mapping has a goal of trying to identify genes contributing to disease or other phenotypes, and using population-based sampling. I think that's what distinguishes it from other forms of genetic approaches to the dissection of traits. So if we think about classical genetics, it's rational, it involves crosses, you make a set of, say, either crosses for plants or families, and then you look at segregation patterns, right? In population genetics, you throw that out the window, and you look at just random correlations among populations. It's been likened to trying to do mouse genetics with subway rats, right? You know, so in mouse genetics, you have all these kinds of classical approaches you can use, but here you're just sort of using whatever you can get your hands on. So why on earth would you do that, right? If you've got a rational, well-designed approach, why would you throw that out the window and use something that may be really kind of nutty? And the advantage really comes from the fact that if you have population-based samples, those individuals are related in a very distant way by a genealogical tree, so that the large number of meioses in the histories of those samples really whittles down the segments of the genomes that are going to be shared identical by descent by individuals that have a given phenotype. What that means is that your resolution can be much, much finer than doing traditional family-based or other approaches. So a common problem that arises, say, in QTL mapping in humans is that you can get the gene down to a megabase. Well, you know, like there could be 10, 100 genes in there, right? How do you really tease that out? And so with this kind of association mapping, you get a much more direct view. The chief source of signal is going to be something known as linkage disequilibrium. I imagine many of you are familiar with this, but again, as a way of sort of equalizing the discussion and starting point, I'm going to define that in a moment. And it has some challenges. The first one is multiple testing, which we've worked on, but I'm not going to really talk about. And the second is population subdivision, and I'll talk a little bit about why population subdivision can be a problem. So the chief approach that we're going to use is one of these SNP chips, and for those of you who aren't familiar with this, all that we need to know is that it's a little bit of technology that allows us to take in DNA and get vast amounts of genotype data. And it basically works as an array where you have 20 probes per SNP, and those probes are often, you know, different size, but let's say that they're about 20 oligonucleotides in length, and you have different probes for one allele versus the other allele in the forward and reverse strand. And the idea is that you just sort of hybridize DNA, and with this little chip, I forgot to bring them, they're about this big, you can look at 500,000 variable sites at once. So that's the setup, and I'll tell you what that data that comes out looks like. And then you're going to take that and do a very, very simple and naive thing, which is you're going to look for allele frequency differences between panels of individuals. So in a caricature of this, we might take cases, we'll define those as individuals that have a disease, control is those individuals that you've screened and said don't have the disease, and then you'll scour the genome. So this line here just represents the genome. Each dash mark is just is a SNP. And so in the first one here, we see there's a sort of 50-50 ratio of allele big A to little a in the cases, and about the same in control. So let's say you had 100 individuals each, that would give you an odds ratio of about 1.22, that is the increased risk of being a case relative to a control based on your genotype. And with that many cases in control, say you had 100, that would be a p-value of 57, of 0.57, nothing sort of interesting. You'd say, well, there's nothing here, so I just move on to the next one. And they'll fluctuate in frequency because they're just random SNPs in the population, right? And so, for example, this one is at about an 80-20 split, right? And again, you haven't done a controlled cross, so they'll just fluctuate with whatever you're testing. But the point is that you're always comparing cases and controls. So again, if you had 100 of individuals from each and you did sort of the Fisher's exact test or your favorite 2x2 test, you wouldn't find anything interesting here. And now you play this game until you find some region that now shows some signal. And so in this case, for example, there's a 70% frequency for the big A allele in cases, but only a 40% in controls, which means that you're about three and a half times more likely to be a case than a control, given that you've got the allele. Right? And so that tells you, well, that's something interesting. Maybe there is really a genetic variant linked to this or near this or maybe this that is involved in the disease. So let me go in, sequence that region, and try to figure out what genes are involved, what the mutation may be, and so on. The point is that you don't necessarily expect a priori these particular markers that you're looking at to be the associated ones, but rather they're giving you a sense of the neighborhood, and by looking at these p-value patterns, telling you where to zoom in. And one of the first examples, and it turns out to be a non-representative example of how this might work, was a paper in 2005 by Josephine Ho, which identified a mutation in a gene called complement factor H, which is related, which is associated with a disease called age-related macular degeneration. Now, we don't need to worry about what the disease is. It's the disease of the eye, and it turns out that what these individuals did is they had a very exquisite form of phenotyping, so they focused in on a very particular form of age-related macular degeneration, and by comparing only about 100 cases and 50 controls, they found a variant that was associated with a risk factor of about 7.4, which is huge, right? I mean, it's a huge effect. And so here's what the kind of data for all of these things look like. This is sort of the first one, so it's quite representative. The name of the game is we have between 0 and 100,000 SNPs. This is the location in the genome. Here I'm just showing the log 10 p-value of association. You get a spike here where you have a strong p-value of 10 to the minus 7th of association between the disease and the genotype. You have a second one here. You then look at these. It turns out that's a genotyping error, right? And so you're left with only one peak, right? I mean, this is sort of how many of these proceed. And so you now go in here and you burrow to see what could be involved. And again, the point here is that it is the correlation structure of the genome that allows you to take this approach to disease gene mapping. So what I'm showing you here, which is straight from this paper, is we can think about it as a variance-covariance matrix, sort of one half of a variance-covariance matrix. Along the top here, I just have what would be the diagonal the diagonal elements, so I and I plus 1, I plus 1 and I plus 2, and so on. And here we've got the sort of the further along elements. And what happens is that you see that in this matrix, there are regions that are highly correlated, right? So this is a region that shows so-called high linkage disequilibrium. Here's another, and here's another, right? So these are the so-called haplotype blocks, which is a very sort of fuzzy sort of description for the phenomenon. I think you should just really think about it as that it's the covariance in allele frequencies among pairs of markers. And so when you see these regions of high covariance, all that means is that one SNP could be a proxy for the other. So you don't need to type the exact disease gene SNP because there's something close to it. And so if you go through and you burrow and sequence, you'll be able to find it. And so in this case, here's the complement factor H. They had a SNP that was associated. They went in, they found it was an amino acid change, and you know, all was good and orderly in the world. Right, so they were able to sort of knock that story out. This approach has now been replicated for dozens of diseases with up to tens and twenties of thousands of individuals for lots and lots of different complex diseases. So one of the things that we want to think about is, how is this working from a modeling kind of perspective, and what are the potential pitfalls that this kind of approach might have? And so one way to think about the problem from a genealogical perspective is the following. Similar to cholesterol, there's good LD and there's bad LD, right? There's good cholesterol and bad cholesterol. This is kind of like what would be termed the good LD. Namely, we are interested in covariance that has to do with shared genealogical history. And so if we think about chromosomes, we can relate all the chromosomes in a sample by, you know, the cholesterol and a genealogical tree. Is there a pointer here by any chance? No. I'll use a low-tech pointer. So if you look at the top there, we see that we've got two loci. We'll call one M for the marker locus. We'll call the second one D for the disease locus. And at the top there, we'll see that all the chromosomes carry the big M allele and the little d allele at the second locus. Okay, and that's sort of the ancestral state. And we'll let M be a marker and D be the disease state. And it'll turn out that this mutation is, say, the mutation that gives rise to the disease. Right? So you have a mutation along this branch that gives you the disease phenotype. Yeah. Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. Even better, Lowe's. Yeah, this is. So here we have, this is the mutation that gives rise to the disease, and here's the marker. Okay, so one thing that is important to note here is that there's actually no recombination here. These things are physically completely linked. They're not, though, in what might be termed complete linkage disequilibrium, for the reason that you don't always have a one-to-one correspondence between having the big M allele and the big D allele, right? There's rather a sort of strong correlation. Namely, I never see this disease allele on a gray background. Right? So there's another mutation here, I should note, that creates a second allele. So this is the marker. So the population's segregating for this guy, and they're segregating for this allele and the white allele. Okay, and so this is what might be termed the good linkage disequilibrium. Namely, if I test for association, there's quite a strong association between carrying the white allele and having the disease, and it has to do with the fact that there's a shared genealogical history. This thing, while not being a perfect mutation to track and predict, does a good job of telling you that you're sort of near the region. And so, I mean, if you wanted something that would be a perfect tracker of this mutation, it'd have to occur exactly on this branch, right? And you know, there won't be all that many mutations that occur on that branch, but something else that's close will sort of help. So this might be termed the good linkage disequilibrium, which has to do with the fact that there are mutations that are shared on this genealogy that will help you distinguish the individuals. We can quantify that degree of association by a very common statistic, which we might call our linkage measure of linkage disequilibrium, and it's intimately related to our 2x2 test. So we might, for example, just count up the number of chromosomes that carry the marker big M versus the marker little m, and the disease big D versus the non-disease little d. And if they were in linkage equilibrium, that is, if there was no association between the marker and the disease, then of course the probability of carrying the marker allele and the disease allele would simply be given by the product of their marginal frequencies, right? This is just, you know, basic probability day one, right? You know, two independent events, you can calculate their joint probability just by multiplying their individual probabilities. A deviation from that, we're going to call little delta. And it turns out that this little delta is exactly our measure of linkage disequilibrium, and in a regular 2x2 setup is right related to our odds ratio. So if you think about degrees of freedom, if I fix these marginal frequencies, I only have one degree of freedom here. So whatever deviation I make in this direction has to be offset exactly by a deviation in this direction. Whatever deviation here has to be offset in that direction, and so on. So this delta is in and of itself a measure of association that both has a biological concept, which is our notion of non-random association between pairs of alleles, and also a statistical measure of association, which is intimately related to the test we're going to use to look for association. Namely, we're going to use individuals that are diseased and individuals that are non-diseased, and then compare their marker genotypes. Does that make sense? Okay, so this is the setup. Now, the problem is that there are lots of ways that we can get linkage disequilibrium. The first is that so-called good linkage disequilibrium, which is that mutation occurs on some genetic background, and it'll track it. And the second one is this so-called admixture linkage disequilibrium, or population stratification admixture disequilibrium, which is a bad form of linkage disequilibrium for our purposes. There's also linkage disequilibrium that could be due to epistasis, that is, if you don't carry the exact allelic combinations, then you might be selectively disfavored. We're going to ignore that for the moment. So here is how this population subdivision linkage disequilibrium comes up, and this is all sort of a setup for the problem we're going to tackle. So let's consider two populations. Here's population one, here's population two. Both are segregating for the marker locus and for the disease locus. And within each population, there's actually zero association. That is to say, my probability of carrying the marker, the big M marker allele and the big D marker allele, are simply the product of the marginal allele frequency 10% times this allele frequency 20%, or 2% for population one. In population two, it's exactly the same, right? Namely, it's the marginal allele frequencies differ, but again, there's no association between the marker and the disease. Now, the problem occurs when I don't know that I have two populations, right? Let's just say I think this is all a single population, and I'm looking at, Europeans in the United States, individuals of European descent, and I don't know that they may be differentially substructured, or Hispanics in the United States, and I don't know that they may have a fair amount of variation within them. And I now just pool these populations. And let's say I pool them and average them in 50-50. So I just take 50% of my individuals from this population, 50% of the individuals from this population. Now, this has been cooked, right? So that the allele frequencies in this are 50% and 50%. So I would expect simply 25%, 25%, 25%, and 25%. I mean, it's just very simple arithmetic. But I have very strong deviations from that. And it's an artifact of simply averaging out over this population stratification problem. This is a simple problem for most people to get, but it's a very tough problem in a real sense to know how to solve. And there are several approaches that have been put forth, and I'll tell you a little bit about some of the things that we've been doing, but I think that one of the hidden problems that I think we're going to see when we begin to analyze the results of these genome-wide association tests and burrow deeper and deeper is that there may be very subtle population structure related to this that, you know, may be responsible for some of these, if not many of these associations. And, you know, I'll sort of leave it at that. There are folks that have been looking at, for example, patterns of population structure in these disease alleles associated versus non-disease allele associated. And it turns out that the disease-associated alleles tend to have a lot more substructure than the non-disease associated alleles, which makes it quite suspicious in my mind. Okay, so yeah.
This is a kind of more general aside. I mean, you're talking about this in the context, say, of disease mapping
yeah.
or something like that. But for evolutionary biologists, as you started out saying, I'll take my model organism and genome.
Absolutely.
People are generally interested in adaptive trait variation.
Absolutely, yep.
And adaptive trait variation often differs in frequencies between populations due to selection.
Yep.
And those populations are geographically structured. So there's a kind of a coincidence of these.
And
you want to find selection in the different populations because that's where the gene frequency differences are. But at the same time, they're structured similarly to create this ungodly amount of noise. So that, you know, any attempt to fix the subdivision problem throws the baby out with the bathwater.
Exactly. So, absolutely. So Magnus, you know, what this, in my mind, brings up a lot of Magnus Norberg's work, where Magnus has been looking at adaptation in Arabidopsis to things like flowering time, which has a strong geographic gradient, and where population structure has a strong geographic gradient, and there is no easy solution to the problem. So there are some things that correcting for population structure will throw out true positives. Anything that's strongly related with your major axis of genetic differentiation will be tossed out, and there's no sort of easy way to do that except to actually do real genetics and to do real crosses and sort of disentangle it in that way. So I actually think that the way to solve these problems, at least say in human populations, is to take a step back and realize that people studied families for a reason. And so if you take a joint approach that includes both family information and unrelated information, you can probably do much better than doing either alone. You know, families also get used in evolutionary biology all the time. So I think there's a general excitement about, oh, it's new technology, I can use it to do all kinds of things, but there are inherent limits to not having done an experiment that you're going to see in this kind of work.
So, following up on that, so given that everybody's used, well, there are a few major SNP chip platforms that people are using, so essentially the same sets of SNPs are genotyped in a lot of different studies. Very often, you know, the patient populations are European Americans, but the phenotypes are quite disparate. You know, so we would expect maybe some of these SNPs. I mean, if there were SNPs that had structure and the associations were due to that, we would expect to see them over and over in different.
Which is happening.
Different diseases. So, are there examples of that?
So there was a report. Either from Wellcome Trust or something similar, where they found a surprising association between a genomic region that was associated with diabetes and with heart disease or something like that.
Type 2 diabetes.
Type 2 diabetes and heart disease. Or, you know, where, oh, we didn't expect to see that at all.
Yeah.
And it was the same region. And so, you know, population structure in the data would cause both to be associated. But, I mean, there could also be a liability allele that predisposes you to both. So,
there are, I mean, the phenotypes are.
But, you know, I think, you know.
It depends on the distribution of the phenotypes. So
yeah.
If the phenotype is an east-west gradient, you'll pick up SNPs that are east-west differentiated. If it has a north-south different pattern, you'll pick up north-south SNPs. So you won't necessarily always see the same SNPs. You'll see the same SNPs if the phenotypes are differentiated in the same way across the population.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I mean, or in the U.S. it might be, you know, you're always comparing German controls to Irish cases or something like that. Then it would go in the same direction. Okay, so can I move on to the macaque story? Hi, sorry.
Just just wanted to go back to this population stratification example to make sure I understand what's going on. So it seems that as long as you're looking only at two loci, you can always explain any correlation away by stratification. But if you start looking at more than two loci, and if one can assume that stratification has to apply, you know, genome-wide as opposed to different stratification of different little regions, then you should have a real constraint that
that
allow you to sort of rule out stratification as an explanation.
So that's
exactly right.
And if we think about this setup here, and we might imagine that there is a background association, which we might call delta, that is common to all pairs that we might want to look at, which has to do with some population substructure, say. If that is the case, there's a statistic that's been sort of... So if that's the case, then if I think about the distribution of my test statistic, that test statistic is no longer going to be asymptotically chi-square. It will be an asymptotic chi-square if the null hypothesis is true, and the null hypothesis is that delta is equal zero. So if delta does not equal zero, it will follow a different distribution that will depend on the true value of delta. An approach has been developed called genomic control, which effectively goes through and tries to estimate delta and then reweigh all of your associations so that you can sort of tackle this problem. If the problem is that you have a ranking and you need to know where to draw the line, then that solves your problem. Because you don't need to reorder your associations. You just go through and figure out where is the real cutoff for my tail. If, on the other hand, the problem is more complex and has to do with some of these things that Marty was talking about, like you have selection in the data or you have differential substructure in different parts of the genome, then that is not an accurate solution. The other thing that ends up happening is that often you don't just have two populations that are contributing, but you may have K populations that are contributing, each contributing differentially in different number of individuals, and so it's actually a tough issue to raise. But you're right that that's a very powerful approach to work that works well in some situations. There's also the case where you could imagine that the allele is associated in one population but not the other, in which case then that delta factor isn't common. And what you really want to do is assign individuals to population and test within populations. That's an approach that Jonathan Pritchard and others have put forth. Likewise, there are cases where it'll flip between populations and so on. So there are all kinds of scenarios we could cook up where some approaches do better than others.
You're assuming that selection does not play a role in this, that you don't have an allele which causes disease in one population, which will never cause a disease in a different population. Because there are examples of
that could certainly happen, right. And so if that's the case, then this idea of just correcting for background won't solve it. Right. Yeah, so that's a real... And the other thing is that there are also environments that will correlate differently with populations. Right, and so it's hard to disentangle those, right? There are some things that are only going to pop up in some environments. If those are correlated with your population designations or population labels, then you could easily make the problem very complex very fast. So to root this in a real problem, I'll tell you about rhesus macaques. So rhesus are widely used biomedical animal models for many human diseases. In particular, they're used as animal models of immunity. And they were recently had a complete genome. They've always had their genome. It was just completely sequenced. They're wonderful large resources for colony phenotyping. So they're wonderful models for primate genetics. So they're something like 15,000 rhesus macaques that we take care of, to put it euphemistically, in the United States, and follow them in exquisite detail. They get much better health care than anyone in this room, unless you're maybe a part of the U.S. Army. You know, they, I mean, they're just really, really wonderfully followed from the perspective of one of these genetics, from the perspective of being a monkey advocate, maybe not. Let's think about it from the perspective of wanting to do medical genetics. So one thing that we were interested in is we needed to quantify levels of genetic variation, population structure, and decay of linkage disequilibrium precisely for these questions of, let's say we wanted to do these genes mapping in rhesus macaque, is this a model system that works? And so as part of our involvement in the monkey genome project, which was led by Richard Gibbs at Baylor, we got Richard to do a little experiment for us. So this was a very nice role reversal from the one that my lab usually has. In my lab, we usually take in copious amounts of data from other people and try to do some interesting statistical analysis. Here we had a harebrained scheme to do some sequencing, and so we called the sequencing center up to see if they would do it for us. And you know, in a moment of irrationality, Gibbs agreed and did our experiment, and then gave us the data. And so this is joint work with my former graduate student Ryan, who's now at Chicago and partner in crime for many things, Rasmus Nielsen. So the experiment was the following. We just wanted to get a background sense of population structure and linkage disequilibrium. And so we resequenced 166 regions of the rhesus macaque genome that were tiled across five independent regions. There were 47 animals that were resequenced, 9 of Indian origin, and 38 of Chinese origin. It turns out that this lopsided sampling can only be, actually I think these are even flipped, it's actually 38 of Indian origin and 9 of Chinese origin. But the point is that we had aimed to do about half and half of each, but as these things tend to happen, there was a sample mix-up, and so we ended up looking at the data saying, boy, some of these Chinese macaques really look like Indian macaques. These really look like Indian macaques. Oh, wait a second, they are Indian macaques. And so at the end, we had 37 Indian and 9 Chinese. It's sort of just the way things are. We collected about 150 kb for each of the animals. Okay, so one of the things that we wanted to do is just do some modeling of the data. And one statistic that my lab has spent a fair amount of time thinking about and working on is the so-called site frequency spectrum or the distribution of allele frequencies. And I think Guttenkunst has talked about this in the past. For those of you who may not be as sort of fixated on the site frequency spectrum as the folks in my lab, it is a summary statistic for the SNPs in your data that simply is a histogram of the frequencies at which you find the SNP. So, for example, in red here, we have the Chinese sample, which had about 1,000 SNPs. And of those SNPs, this is a frequency out of 10 chromosomes, to sort of put it all in a common so let's say 10%, about 50% of the SNPs were between 0 and 10%. About 20% were about between 10 and 20% and so on. And what's interesting is that we can use population genetic theory, as you've probably heard throughout this course, to make predictions about what this curve should look like, and those predictions are here in the black histogram bars. And what we see is that the Chinese macaques showed a pattern that was way to this, you know, skew in this direction of way too many low frequency variants, whereas the Indian macaques showed the opposite pattern. So this led us to think that perhaps Indian macaques and Chinese macaques have had quite different demographic histories. We made a joint frequency map here, which goes from 0 to 9 and 0 to 37 here. And this just sort of tells us about the joint frequencies of the variants. And Ryan Guttenkunst has worked a lot on how we can take this kind of data and fit demographic models to it. And so the other thing we can do is just calculate very common population genetic measures of population differentiation. One of these is so-called Wright's FST, which is a measure of genetic variation within to variation between. And we see that, for those of you who are sort of aficionados of these kinds of statistics that there's a fair amount of FST across the markers. These really are pretty differentiated populations. If we do principal component analysis here on the genotypes, we can clearly separate our Indian samples from our Chinese samples. And we've also developed a clustering algorithm similar to structure, which can deal with inbreeding, and when we apply that algorithm, it clearly separates Indian and from Chinese. So this leads us to believe, yes?
Aren't you worried that the Chinese and the Indians are very similar to each other? You have almost no variation at all. It's as if they are totally inbred. Look at the principal components. There's no variation in the second dimension at all. Everything is explained by one principal component.
Right. Right. That's telling us that the primary differentiation is India versus China.
But there is nothing else.
Well, principal component gets rescaled, right? And so it's explaining this has to do with this outlier individual, which may be different than the rest. Right, so if I were to do principal component within
India. What fraction does this explain?
That's a wonderful question for Ryan, because I don't remember the answer to that. But I would say it's some, you know, I'm going to guess in the 15%. I mean, it's something like on that order, PC1. I'm going to just shoot from the hip. We'll look it up, but I think it's sort of thing on that order.
If it explains 80%.
It's not 80%. It's not 80%. And in fact, this is sort of a crude measure of what percentage of the variation is going to be explained. This actually comes directly from F statistics, and so it's something like 15% of the variance is explained by the population designations. Okay, so one of the things that our lab has worked on are how to take that sort of data and fit a simplistic, naive, utterly ridiculous kind of model, sorry Ryan, like this, where we've just had a population and then at some instant in time, the population magically changes size and it's now at this size NC. Right, so we know that this is a ridiculously simplistic model, but it turns out that the resolution that we have from genetic data for the kinds of demographic models that we would like to fit is no match for the kinds of real demography that we think is going on, and so we have to start with simple models. And so we can think about this as, well, we can quantify this in terms of this ratio of how big was the ancestral population relative to the current population. And so if the ancestral population was smaller, then we've had population growth. If the population was the same size, we have these green lines. And then if the population, ancestral population size was much bigger, then we have these blue bars. And so if you remember the Chinese versus Indian, this looks a lot more like the Chinese data, and this looks more like the Indian data, which leads us to suggest the Chinese have undergone an expansion and the Indians have undergone a contraction. So we've done something slightly more sophisticated than that I don't have all the details on because I want to get to other things. And we fit a model that looks something like this, that macaques arose somewhere in the Malay archipelago, and they have a common ancestry that dates back to about 2 million years, which is really quite old for primate species. It turns out that the population size of macaques is gigantic relative to humans. Effective population size is one of these sort of crazy numbers where if I tell you the number that we estimate for humans, you're going to think it's, you know, utterly ridiculous. And that number is 10,000. And so, which makes no sense, right? I mean, you think about it, you know, how can there really be, how can humans act as if it were a population of 10,000? It has a lot to do with the fact that for a long time we were small and there were cycles and so on. And so,
doesn't include Africans.
It does include Africa, yeah. So, yeah, it's a weird number. I mean, so 10 to 20,000 or something. You know, I mean, it's sort of like you don't get much beyond that. So it's not hundreds of thousands of individuals, you know, even though there's 6 billion people on the planet. So when we do the same kind of estimate for macaques, we get that the effective population ancestrally of macaques is like 73,000. So whether or not we believe that's a real number, that number tells us that it was about 7 times bigger than our population's ancestral population size. And today, the effective population size of Chinese macaques is 240,000. So again, about an order of magnitude bigger than our own species. And, you know, there are lots and lots and lots of macaques. They've been an incredibly successful species. In fact, probably the most successful primate species aside from humans. Interestingly, the Chinese macaque seem to have had the Indian macaque seem to have had a very different history. Namely, they seem to have gone through a pretty severe bottleneck so that they have an effective population size today closer to our own, but that is still much smaller than the ancestral population size. And the reason this is interesting is that it leads to quite different patterns of linkage disequilibrium. So if we think about patterns of linkage disequilibrium in Indian rhesus macaques, there tends to be a lot more linkage disequilibrium at short distances than even those that we see in humans. So here's the data. This dark blue line. Here are simulations that Ryan carried out under the demographic model that suggest that demographic model is a good explanation. Here's what data looks like for human African populations, which seem to have the lowest. That's green. That's green. Okay, that's for human European populations, which have some of the longest LD. Of human populations, and we see that Chinese macaques have even more LD than human populations. Here is what human African populations look like, which seem to have the lowest LD, and Chinese macaques are way on the opposite side. So these two different macaque populations have a much bigger difference in linkage disequilibrium than human populations, and it means that if I were to go out and want to do genetic disease mapping, here's a test, which one should I use? Should I use Indian or Chinese?
Chinese.
Why should you use the Chinese?
They're more divergent.
Okay, but then I'll need, my experiment will cost me much more money. That was actually a trick question, and you were right. You know, so you actually want to, you might want to use a combined strategy where you start with Indian and then go to Chinese. The Chinese will definitely give you a much finer resolution.
About the effective population size.
Yeah.
Isn't that a locus dependent statement? I mean, totally locus dependent. Because the Y chromosome effective population size is much smaller than the mitochondrial.
Yeah. This is all autosomal, but you're right. Yeah.
So, but then there is no meaning really to genome-wide population size because that's.
I mean, there in the sense that it gives you a background estimate of diversity that is. You know, it's comparable in some sense.
It's also sampling dependent, right? Depends on.
Yeah, so one thing is that these Indian macaques, for legal reasons, were all sampled in the United States. As many of you know, there's an embargo. We did not go out and capture Indian macaques. If I were admitting to that here, you could arrest me under CITES, right? Like, you're not allowed to take DNA sample out of India. These were all U.S.-born macaques, whereas the Chinese are all captive. We're all Chinese-born. And so there may be an effect of that. We did look at a bunch of markers to look whether these animals look particularly inbred or related, and they don't. But, you know, there is a bottleneck there in terms of the founding of the populations in the U.S. Okay, so that is all prelude to a kind of interesting application of this, which is that we became interested in the following, I think, quite practical problem, namely that macaques are the primary animal models for AIDS. So, as some of you may know, primates vary greatly in their susceptibility to and consequence of infection by simian and human immunodeficiency viruses. So there are some monkeys that you can infect with SIV and HIV and they never get AIDS. They just don't get AIDS. Rhesus are not some of those monkeys. If you infect rhesus with SIV, they will come down with AIDS. Some will come down with AIDS much faster than others, but almost all of them come down with AIDS. There are some so-called long-term non-progressors, but as a rule, they tend to come down. And Indian and Chinese animals differ dramatically in their susceptibility. So Indian macaques get AIDS after being infected within about 18 months, and Chinese macaques tend to live for about 3 years. So there's a big population difference, and there's a huge interest in the medical community to try to understand this problem because medical researchers all want Indian animals since they come down with AIDS much faster. And, you know, if you can get your experiment done in half the time, why not do it? And so this is a collaboration between my lab. This is Jeremiah Degenhart and this picture of Dashing Yoav Gilad. I mean, this is only the only way to describe him in that photograph. I don't think that's in Chicago. I think that's from Israel. But yeah, I think that's still a picture that Yoav uses as his official, you know, sanctioned photo. So here's the story I want to tell you about is about a gene that we focused on that we thought might be important for this problem. And the reason we focused on it is sort of a bit of serendipity. So Jeremiah was looking at the genomic data that was coming off of this project, and we just happened to have read this paper by Gonzalez et al. In Sunil Ahuja's lab in Texas. And that paper was a very interesting paper, and the paper described the following. It told the story that there's a gene known as CCL3 that differs in copy number in humans. So some people have more copies of this gene, some people have fewer copies. And the number of copies that you carry seems to be correlated with the time that you survive post-infection until you get AIDS. Okay? And so this gene, CCL3, chemokine ligand 3, turns out to be a ligand. That is, it binds this receptor called CCR5, which is used by HIV to get into the cells. So CCR5 is a classically studied protein. It's used by HIV to get into the cell. We know that there are mutations in CCR5 that knock out function, and if you don't have a functioning CCR5, then HIV doesn't get in. In fact, there's a mutation, CCR5 delta 32, which is sort of famous for this. Novembre is actually written on this as well, and there are, in fact, Cuban people walking around who are immune to AIDS because they just can't get in. Okay, so CCL3 binds this guy, and the hypothesis was, well, if you have more copies of the gene, you produce more protein, it may be binding competitively to inhibit this entry. And when they looked at the data, they found this correlation. They also found that chimps who don't get AIDS have about twice as many copies of CCL3 than humans. And so that may explain why chimps are not a good model for HIV/AIDS, because you just can't give them AIDS. And so when we looked at macaque, or when Jeremiah looked at the macaque, he found two copies. We said, oh, well, maybe this is why macaques can get AIDS. It might be an important thing to look at. And it's also been suggested that CCL3 expression may be the most important factor determining HIV susceptibility in maternal fetal. So this is some data from the genome to sort of set this up. This is done in collaboration with Evan Eichler's lab. And for those of you who don't know about how to look at this, this is a so-called shotgun sequence depth plot. And what we're seeing here is that there are, when you do genomic sequencing, you're taking short fragments and sequencing those short fragments and then aligning them to the genome. So if you've had a genome segment that's been duplicated, then you might find many more copies than you would expect. So if on average you've got 6x coverage, you expect to see 6 copies of a molecule that are binding to that region. If that region's been duplicated, you might see 12 copies. If it's triplicated, then you might see 18 copies. And so the more number of copies you see, the more regions. And so this sort of difficult to see plot along down here, you have sort of more and more copies. And so this led us to think that by looking at these kinds of plots, that rhesus had fewer copies than other populations. And so what we did is first start out by looking at different primates. So we took some Indian rhesus macaques, some Chinese rhesus macaques, humans, orangs, chimpanzees, African green monkeys, which are not known to progress to HIV AIDS once infected, and Sudimangabe. And when you look at the data, you certainly find that there's a huge amount of copy number variation. So here's what the range of copy number variation looks like in humans. Here's that chimp result, that is that chimps have about twice as many copies as humans. Interestingly, orangs have low copy number variation. We may return to that in a moment. African green monkeys have high copy number variation relative to what we see in humans. These guys don't get AIDS. And rhesus macaques have huge variance in copy number, just huge variation. Sudimangabes don't have high copy number and don't progress, so they may be an outlier. It may not explain the whole story. The point here was to say, well, rhesus macaque have a lot of variation. Let's now break this up further into Indian versus Chinese. Here's the human again. Here's the chimp. Twice as many copies. Here's the average for Indians. Here's the average for Chinese, and it's going in the same direction.
Why should increase? Can you say why in biology increased copy numbers?
So increased copies of the gene would give you increased, in theory, copies of the protein.
Yes.
Okay, and the more proteins, and this is all storytelling, but the more copies, the more it would bind to the receptor. So if the receptor is bound, then HIV can't get in. It would effectively be as if I were to knock out the receptor, and HIV can't get in. If I'm binding it up all the time, then it's as if I'm blocking it. That's at least in theory. Yeah.
Didn't you just say that rhesus just have two copies, or did I miss something?
That one rhesus individual, that was the genome donor. I mean, that's why I said serendipitous. Had we sequenced one of the guys that had 30 copies, we wouldn't have thought about it.
Okay.
But that one individual, so we went out and then did a population sampling. Of course, I've just spent the first half of this lecture telling you about causation and correlation and not to draw too much conclusion on population substructure. And so we really need to do a controlled experiment. And this is about as close to a controlled experiment as you're going to get to in this field. So what we did, which again was sort of just one of those kind of fortuitous things, we hooked up with a guy named Preston Marks, who runs the Tulane AIDS Vaccine Clinic. And what Preston had was a ton of data that they have accumulated from SIV trials. So whenever you do a vaccine trial, you have to infect a series of monkeys that you don't give the vaccine to, and you follow them until they die, right? So they had this wonderful data on which animals had been infected, how long they had lived, and what they died of. And for us, it was very easy to figure out how many copies of CCL3 they had. So we could do what's known as a retrospective epidemiological study, where we try to correlate the number of copies with the disease outcome. So there were about 57 animals in this study, which is about the largest study you can do here. I mean, you know, keeping these animals alive cost a huge amount of money. All these vaccine trials like had 5 or 6 animals, so this wasn't like, you know, oh, you guys were lazy and didn't want to do it. I mean, like, this is it. This is like the number of animals that have been infected and used for AIDS vaccine trials and followed, right? So let's look at it and see if we find anything. And the animals were chosen if they'd been euthanized due to health complications for CD AIDS or remained AIDS free for greater than 18 months. And so the model we're going to use is what's known as a Cox proportional model. The Cox proportional hazard model is a sort of statistical model that is what's known as semi-parametric. And all that means is we have some baseline hazard function, and that hazard function just tells you, given that you're this old, how likely are you to have the disease outcome versus the non-disease outcome? And that is going to be sort of estimated from the data. And then what you're going to do is, for a given individual at time t, estimate their individual disease hazard rate as a function of the baseline rate for an individual of that age. Here, age is really a proxy for when they got infected, and then a linear combination of factors. I mean, it's just sort of a classical regression setup. And so we can use in here, for example, covariates such as the number of CCL3 or population of origin or interaction effects. You then have a kind of interesting little problem, which is that some individuals in your data set aren't dead yet. Right, and so you have to deal with what are known as censored versus uncensored observations, and what Cox did was sort of set this up in this so-called penalized or sort of approximate likelihood sort of framework. Basically, all we need to think about for our point of view is that we can incorporate uncensored and censored individuals, and we considered three models. The first is a model of no effect. The second is a model where CCL3 has a covariate, and then the third is a model with both CCL3 and population structure. Because we know CCL3 differs between the populations, we know the disease outcome differs, and so the question is, can we first see an effect of CCL3, and when we include population structure as a covariate, does that effect go away? So here's the data. On the x-axis, I have CCL3 copy number. On the y-axis, we have survival in months. Black are Indian animals, red are Chinese animals, filled in are animals that are still alive, and these are all animals that are diseased. And you can clearly kind of see, just from looking at the data, that there is an increased survivorship with increased copy number. And there's sort of Mr. Super Duper on both, right? So this guy both has many, many copies and is long-lived, and so we can exclude this guy and redo our things, and our analyses don't change. It's all sort of based on the proportional hazard. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, this is a complex trait, right? You're talking about survivorship post-infection, right? We know it's not a single gene. There's lots of things that are contributing. So the question is, can we eke out any signal here? And the answer is that a model which includes CCL3 as a covariate provides a significantly better fit to the data. And the model's really only marginally improved when you add population of origin, so that this is not explained by population of origin. It really seems to be this sort of CCL3, but there may likely be other factors that, that are important. We can also do the analysis just looking at Indian animals, and we see that there is a significant effect. So it really seems to be that we've replicated this CCL3 copy number story in humans in macaques and sort of have accounted for the population structure issue. And this has a real practical implication, which is if you are designing a disease vaccine trial, you don't want to include monkeys that have 30 copies of CCL3 because they're just not going to be accurate representatives of what's going on in human populations.
Sorry, what is population of origin?
Whether they're Indian or Chinese.
Oh, right, okay.
The other thing we can do is do these so-called Kaplan-Meier survival curves, which give you a sense of how strong the effect is. So here is CCL3 copy number. So we're going to call things with below 9 copies, say low. Those with above 9 copies is intermediate. And so if I look at either Indian populations or Chinese populations, here's the survivorship curve for animals that have less than 8 copies. Here's those that have more than 8 copies, and you see that there is quite a difference in the survivorships. Here is for the pooled, and we can look in sort of 3 categories, and we see that, you know, maybe there is or there isn't an effect. It seems to be that, you know, I would say there's probably a thresholding, but in any case, you see that it's not really about how this high tail is defined, but really about how this low tail is defined. So the low...
Yeah, is this months since infection?
Months post-SIV infection. And we can then take this all and make predictive models. Okay, so there is also a kind of evolutionary argument that we'd like to maybe just throw out there. This is completely speculative, so you know I wouldn't run out and bank on this. But one thing that we know about SIV distribution is that it looks much like a map of Africa. Namely, all of the SIV seems to be restricted to sub-Saharan Africa. Primates outside of Africa don't naturally carry SIV. They're not SIV reservoirs. And as I've just told you, the history of macaque populations seems to have been one of having evolved in Asia and spread out to the continent. So these animals didn't really get challenged with SIV until we brought them into the lab and infected them. And so this low copy number variation seems to be just a sort of fortuitous association in this population. So if they haven't responded to SIV, then you haven't sort of culled that tail of the distribution. It may be that the African natural primates have all sorts of things that they've evolved to resist HIV infection, and so really they may not be very good animal models, right? Because they've been challenged for a long time, and so they've already evolved all these sort of resistance factors. So if you really want to model the disease, you probably are much better off taking an organism that's never been challenged with it, and it may have more of the sort of ancestral immune system that we have, and maybe the same reason that we're susceptible to it. Just sort of put that out. So in conclusions, and I thought we might take a break after this and then return if that makes sense. There seems to be evidence for different demographic histories of Indian and Chinese macaques. CCL3 copy number extends across diverse non-human primate species, may explain differences in survivorship between Indian and Chinese origin macaques. We estimate that it explains something like 18% of the variance, which for a complex trait is pretty huge. We may be overestimating this, but I mean it's sort of more on the order of between 10 and 20%. Asian origin primates may be more susceptible to SIV due to the lack of shared evolutionary history with the virus. And one thing that is really important that I want to emphasize as a strong caveat of this work is that we've taken what's known as a candidate gene approach. We said, we think CCL3 may be important. Let's look at it. Oh, look, it looks like it's important. We haven't looked at the rest of the genome. It may well be that there are other factors that are as important or more important in this. And so I think, as with all candidate gene studies, you have to take this with a bit of a grain of salt. It replicates what's seen in CCL3 in humans. But, you know, we haven't done the full experiment of looking everywhere in the macaque genome for all these individuals and trying to correlate it with the disease, which is obviously the right thing to do. This was sort of a logical thing to do, and it seems to be going in the direction of supporting previously known results, but you know, I wouldn't bank on it until we've looked at everywhere else in the genome. With that, I'd like to take a break before we get to the last part of the talk. Okay. So in the last sort of third of this talk, which will probably not be that long, I just wanted to tell you a little bit about worldwide patterns of human SNP variation and their relevance to some of these disease gene mapping questions and the extent of population substructure. So this is part of a project that we began in collaboration with Matt Nelson from GlaxoSmithKline and a certain random folks from the population genetics community. John November, who of course is Novembre, who's here in the audience and quite sensitive about the way his last name is pronounced. The purpose of the project was to sort of assemble a large repository of genetically diverse DNA samples, and so they've genotyped about 6,000 samples. These were genotyped on an AFI 500K platform, which is a common platform used for many disease gene studies, and what they wanted to do was establish a resource for studying human population genetics, recent demography, and admixture, and these data are now, the demographic data and genotype data are publicly available, and need to acknowledge many of the folks from my lab who were involved in this project. This is a sort of two-year effort. John is sort of listed at the top because he really helped captain this through this project. He's a sort of full collaborator on all this work, and it was really a really great project. So as an aside, it's very funny that when you ask computational biology graduate students to send you pictures of themselves for your presentations, they always send you pictures of themselves outside, right? So Nelson's on a hike, John's there, this guy, you know, Auten's by a waterfall, right? No one's like sends you a picture of sitting in front of their computer, which is what they normally spend all their time doing, right? They're sending you their, you know, Jeremiah's like, you know, tying his shoes as he's about to sort of dash into the forest or something like that. So it's very, sociology of it's very interesting. I wonder if you ask an ecologist, you know, if they'll then, huh?
They're displaying their fitness.
They're displaying their fitness, yeah. Exactly. So some of the questions we can begin to address with these questions are, with these data, for example, are to what degree are modern human populations accessible for medical genetic studies, substructured? What are accurate models for describing human genetic diversity? And can we use these kinds of data to reconstruct recent personal genetic history? So here's a Google map of the PopRes sample. This is actually slightly out of date, but most of the data I'll talk about follows from this format. So first, we see there's a very strong European component. Many of these individuals were sampled from Lausanne, Switzerland, or from London. So there's about 3,500 Europeans. There's a large U.S. cohort, about 500 U.S. Europeans. There's 400 African Americans, 200 Mexicans. We've got some South Asian samples, for which we also have language group information. We have Europeans and actually East Asians from Australia. There are some East Asian samples, both from Japan and from Taiwan. And we've intersected the HapMap samples, which include both U.S., SAF, the 60 individuals from the Yoruban individuals from Ibadan, Nigeria, and the Han Chinese, as well as the Japanese from Tokyo. And so one of the things that you immediately come into thinking about is data management and visualization. So just to give you what this data looks like, it's a gigantic matrix of zeros, ones, and twos, right? And so we code the data as a zero if the individual carries a genotype little a, a heterozygote gets coded as a one, and a homozygote for the big A gets coded as a two. So it's sort of the classical quantitative genetic gene dosage coding. And we have 500,000 rows because we've had 500,000 SNPs, and we have about 6,000 500,000 columns and 6,000 rows. So it's a pretty big matrix. Maybe for physicists, this is a trivial matrix. For us, it's a big matrix. And there's also lots of question marks in these matrix because there are regions where we, some SNPs for which we have missing.
How did you pick? So this is a SNP chip.
SNP chip. Yes. And so one thing that we've thought about is, you know, principal component analysis. For those of you who, as you'll recall, the point of principal component analysis is to give us a sense of the largest directions of the data. So if we've got, for example, something that's correlated in XY space, PC1 is going to lie along the diagonal, PC2 is going to lie off the in the off diagonal. So in our transformed and recentered spaces, recentered and renormalized spaces, it's going to sort of be a bivariate normal about 0, 0 with PC1, you know, giving us the larger spread. A nice property of PCA is that if we've got clusters in multidimensional space in our retransformed space, they should retain some of that clustering. And this is all a setup for Captain Novembre's talk on Friday, which will give you, I assure you, much more about principal component and its relationship to population genetics than you ever thought to ask. So it'll be a quite thorough and a very important work in telling us about how different population genetics and demographic models play themselves out in PCA space. And one thing that I can't emphasize enough, that this is really going to be a fair amount of tea leaf reading, because we've taken a very non-parametric and sort of multi-purpose exploratory data visualization tool, and we've tried to take human genetic data and tell stories about it. And it's very difficult to really reconcile that with the more model-based population genetic approaches, where you've taken and you've taken a population genetic model, you have data, and you try to fit the model to data. This is a sort of very backwards approach, and there's nobody better than John to really give us intuition about how this works, because he's sort of the master of this kind of tea leaf reading. So it can't be emphasized enough. So when we begin to look at the data, we start to see some really interesting and striking patterns, namely that our principal components seem to correlate quite well with particular axes of variation that have to do with geographical structuring. So principal component 1, for example, seems to separate the Yoruba, these are from Ibadan, Nigeria, from the Europeans, and the African Americans in the sample lie right along principal component 1. You don't see any African Americans out here. Yes?
We've done exactly the same thing for HapMap 3 and for the HGDP data.
Yeah.
And the picture looks exactly the same. I can show it to you in the afternoon.
I'm sure I have an HGDP one coming up, and HapMap 3 is... And the idea here is that for African Americans, they have admixed ancestry both from African and from European ancestries. And we've had a paper. This is actually... this is from... Part of this is an Auden et al. We have the Nelson et al. Paper that came out in American Journal and detailed the sort of first pattern in the data. Interestingly, principal component 2 is a Eurasian principal component, which is separating Europe from East Asia. On one side of the globe, we have individuals of South Asian origin that lie geographically between Asia and Europe. We can think about looking at the other half of the world, and we have Mexico, which also seems to have a contribution of Europe and East Asia.
I just want to point out that for those of you who are not here, Simon Myers gave a talk about work in progress to try to actually identify the populations and estimate the age of admixture from these kind of 500 SNP data. Chips, and it was really a fascinating talk, but he didn't show these kind of principal components, but just seeing that principal component, you get actually maybe a better visual of why it might be able to work.
Right. So I'm not...
He spent a long time trying to convince you why, you know, this kind of massaging the data might work, and perhaps never convincingly, except that the results came out.
All right.
And this maybe gives a nice visual, but that talk's online.
Great. So that, I think they use kind of a variant of the Lee and Stevens haplotype phasing algorithm, right? So this is completely different in some sense, and much more, I would say, kind of data-driven as opposed to population genetic model-driven. And in many ways, this is sort of a description of the data, as you're saying, of the global patterns. Principal component 3, interestingly, separates South Asia and East Asia. And then principal component 4, we could think about as a Mexican admixture principal component, namely only the Mexicans lie on this principal component. What's very interesting is, if you look at this, you see that this is basically going from a European ancestry to an unsampled population, right? It's pulling away from an East Asian. So it's not Europe to East Asia, but rather what would be the separation between the East Asian population and the ancestral Native American or current day Native American populations that are contributing the admixture component to present-day Mexican. And one of the things that we have at our disposal, as you mentioned, is the HTTP data. We've intersected this with HTTP. There are about 70,000 SNPs that are common to both, and it's really beautiful to see that when we look at principal component 3 and 4, the Native Americans pop in exactly where you would predict from this sort of Mexican admixture analysis. The other thing that I think is really important is that if you've ever seen people talk about the HapMap samples, they'll do PCA on the HapMap samples, and you'll have Ceph on one end, you'll have the East Asians on the other, you'll have Yoruba, and as Andy Clark likes to say, they look like chickens, cows, and dogs, or something like that, right? But it's a complete artifact of just looking at three geographically isolated populations. When you start to look and properly look at geographic sampling, that clustering begins to fall apart, because most of the geographic structure seems to be driven by geography. You know, there's actually a really interesting paper that Rosenberg and Feldman and Pritchard did, looking at this question of when you thin the data and you do these analyses, what is the effect of clusters and clines, and encourage you to take a look at that, because I think it's there's an actual data representation issue here that is quite important for lots of reasons, not the least of which is the sociological ones, where people look at those plots and see race. And I think it's really important to take a step back and think critically about how we display these data, how we talk about these data, what we really are seeing in the data, and how it might relate to the actual and appropriate models for human genetic variation. Yes.
So when you add population, is the actual clustering that changes, or that there are gaps that get filled?
The distances are slightly different.
Yeah.
Right, because the distances. So principal component depends on the samples you have, the sample sizes. There are all kinds of subtle impacts that they have. It's, to me, it was mostly just interesting that these individuals, so these are the same individuals that were outliers on that, and they
right.
remain outliers here, but now they begin to cluster with the Native Americans.
But usually
right,
relative.
But the Native, like for example, that is the if there were a, there was a way to characterize the clustering of the Native Americans, is it the same? Whether you include the Mexicans or not.
I see. So you could do that. So you can you can run PCA and then plot these individuals based on the PCAs that you've calculated for the others,
mm-hmm.
as a way of checking.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is again just a teaser for John's talk. If we take and look at principal components 1 and 2 for just the European data. We begin to see that the geographic patterns that the genetic patterns are recapitulating the geography of Europe. So we have the Swiss in the middle, we have the Spanish individuals in the Iberian Peninsula to the west, we have the Boot of Italy, we have the Turks over here, the U.S. and the U.K., much like in Magnus's and their special relationship. And so it's really kind of striking that you can take principal component analysis, which is very sort of off-the-shelf, nothing genetic in PCA, and feed it some high SNP chip data and get to something that really resembles a true geographic map of Europe, and raises the question of how can you use this information for perhaps ancestry reconstruction and ancestry inference.
So this reflects what? Genetic isolation, I guess.
Shared genetic, non-random mating in Europe, right? If you live in Spain, you're more likely to mate with somebody else from Spain than you are to mate from somebody from Norway. And if you play this out for many generations, it gives you a...
This makes it very hard to do disease association, because it means any marker you find, you'll have to remove population structure to prove that it's right.
Well, in that paper, so there's a... The captain's paper here came out in Nature, and I encourage you to take a look at that. He deals with some of these questions of if you have a phenotype that shares a clinal pattern, how strong does that association need to be in order to give you a false positive? And for some things it's real, for something else it's not. So for example, height turns out to be strongly correlated with geography, and you would do poorly in trying to map height genes using European samples. You'll map ancestry informative markers. So there are others. Cholesterol, I think, was well correlated or poorly correlated. I don't.
One of the cholesterols is sort of higher.
Yeah. So, but then there are other phenotypes that didn't seem to show an association. We can also do this for some of the other populations. So, even if we look within the East Asian samples, for example, we can separate the Han Chinese from Taiwan from those in Beijing, and I believe these may be Southern Han Chinese or something like that. The Japanese samples are also slightly different from Japan and Sydney. And there's a paper that just came out in the American Journal of Human Genetics that looked at 7,000 Japanese, and they find strong geographic substructure even within Japan. South Asia seems to have quite interesting clustering, where we have a strong correlation with, you know, jointly geography and language, since geography and language are correlated. So the Dravidian-influenced speakers from southern India are sort of clustering together to the exclusion of those from northern India, which are non-Dravidian speakers. If you look at these are the sort of structure plots down here. We can separate the Chinese and the Japanese samples. The Indian samples show a fair amount of admixture, but the admixture seems to be quite different in those from southern India as those from northern India. I should say that these are quite rough categories. This was not a study designed to look at Indian diversity. It's a hugely diverse country, as anyone who has been to India knows. But it's interesting that we're beginning to see these patterns. I know David Reich, for example, has a much better sampling, both of caste populations and of indigenous populations, and I think it's just going to be really interesting to try to tease apart those signals of where this admixture is coming from.
These are not chosen from indigenous people, right?
These are not indigenous people. These are Indians in London.
No, but the Japanese in Sydney seem to be inbred with Japanese in general, right?
So yeah, these aren't
cross breeding between Japanese from Sydney and other people from Sydney. Not
right. Right, right.
They keep themselves separate.
Well, these may be like one generation transplant, so it may not.
So it seems interesting to me what kind of time depth generates the differences that we can see here, right? Because so in that case of the Japanese could be particularly interesting. So is the idea that the Japanese sampled in Sydney came from a particular region within Japan?
Yeah, I think that's probably a better bet.
Or is it that they came from anywhere in Japan
and then drifted?
A little time that they've been in Sydney has been enough to change their appearances. What do you think is going on?
I don't think we know the answer to that question. You see substructure within Japan. And so if you take northern Japan and southern Japan, you know, they look different. But even, you know, within Mexico, you see huge substructure effects. You know, all of these countries show substructure. And so if you've taken a particular random subset of individuals, I mean, even as I understand it, I haven't seen the data, but Joel Hirshhorn can differentiate Bostonians from English, right? You know, they cluster quite sort of separately. So, I mean, the other thing, to be 100% truth in advertising, these may be differences also doing genotyping platform, right? So PCA is exquisitely sensitive to those sorts of issues and can pick up on genotyping issues. And so, you know, I wouldn't sort of inhale on this too deeply until you've sort of done a proper study of information with where did the four grandparents come from, or the eight great-great-grandparents, and that sort of thing.
But at least the huge difference between the Han Chinese and the CHB from Beijing.
Mm.
So if you take all the data, put it in one plot, and take the centers of clusters, do the distances match what you expect from the known emergence?
Yeah, it's hard to know what you expect.
Well, no. So, can you assume a model that says that the drift is happening at a constant rate?
Right.
And do the distances?
I'm going to defer that one to John on Friday because he's got tons of stuff on how to do that.
You're going to show that.
You have here in your first principal component. So, I understand that it's 1.1% of the variance.
Yeah.
But is that a small number or a big number? So, I just want to get the absolute scale here. So
that's a great question. Depends on. So, I guess the way to think about this is that if we think about worldwide patterns of human diversity, we know that close to 7 or 8% can be explained by differences among major geographic groups. Another 7 or 8% can be explained by variance within major geographic groups. That would be one of them. And then the remainder is variance within geographic groups. So this is telling you something like, if I think about Han Chinese and Japanese as a group, only about 1% of the variance is due to being Han Chinese versus Japanese. But that 1% is enough that you can distinguish them once you've looked at 500,000 points, right? Because you've got hundreds of markers that are strongly associated, even if it's only 1%. Does that make? Yeah. I think that's the way I wrap my head around it, right? Did you have a question, Boris? No? Okay.
Well, it would be nice to see the spectrum of eigenvalues of the PCA.
Yeah, I concur. We've been thinking a lot about the best ways to estimate the number of significant eigenvalues in the data. Turns out that that is a non-trivial problem. The solution that's been proposed by Patterson et al., which relies on this Tracy-Widom distribution, is probably inappropriate. The sort of asymptotics just aren't right.
But so on the worldwide scale, you couldn't expect that, like, you know, the world is two-dimensional case. So maybe there's only so and so many.
Yeah, but I mean, there are other issues here, right, which is that you've sampled clusters and, you know, not all places are accessible from all other places, and so.
It doesn't look exponential, or do you have sort of a bunch of things and then it drops to noise? Or?
It's more exponential.
Yeah. You can keep. Yeah, exactly.
Why is Tracy-Widom inappropriate? Why is Tracy-Widom inappropriate?
Because you're, you know, because the data here are all 0, 1, 2 counts, and I think that the. The theory that it relies on, I'm sorry? It's Gaussian, right, exactly. And so, you know, you're approximating a discrete distribution by this normal distribution, and it's highly sort of structured in a way that those, the multi-dimensional Gaussians just aren't a right approximation for how those tails are decaying. And it all kind of depends on how fast those tails really decay. And so we've done some stuff like where we've simulated data, permuted, and looked at Tracy-Widom and what it associates, you know. So, you know, it's sort of like back to your genomic control idea, right? You can, if you recalibrate it, then you could probably do something that's reasonable. But if you apply to this data, you might get 200 significant principal components, and they'll have to do with things that, from a real biological sense, just probably aren't at all that interesting. They may not even have real interpretations and may have more to do with how fast Tracy-Widom decays than anything that's real. The last thing I wanted to show was this.
Like 40, 50 significant eigenvalues, and it's really hard to interpret those. Only the first few are correlating with the geographic categories.
Or with anything that, you know. So at one point, John, for example, found that PC2 was the day the samples were run, which raised some bells. We had some bad samples and we had to toss them out. And then it became PC4. So we said, oh, it's fine. You know, we just care about the first two because it's young. The other issue is that for the Mexican admixture, I find this particularly interesting. So if you just take the Mexican individuals, you PCA them up with a Europe and East Asia, you find that, so principal component one is this sort of Mexican admixture between Europe and East Asia, but then you also see that clearly what's happening here is that these East Asian populations are really a poor proxy for the Native Americans. You really can further separate them from what would be the Native American population that they're pulling to over here.
So why is it that the Mexicans are so diverse compared to the Europeans?
Because Mexicans range from having 10% European ancestry to having 90% European.
So these include Mexicans who lived in Mexico long before the Europeans came.
Right. Well, I mean, there's a wide range, right? I mean, Mesoamerica
was huge
when the Europeans landed, and not that many Europeans landed.
Right. So it must mean that the markers in your chip cover genetic variation across more than the 200,000 years that we've come out of Africa. I mean, is this distance approximately? What is the length of this? What is the time of this difference?
So Guttenkunz has estimated it to be the distance between
between the Mexicans, you know, from one end of the Mexicans to the other end.
But this is, I mean, so an individual that, so we'll get, let me get to something close that I think may get to this point. So, because I think it relates to this issue of trying to reconstruct personal genetic ancestry, and I just love this painting by Norman Rockwell that, you know, this little boy probably has no idea, right, that he has on one side of the tree this sort of wild Bill Hickok sort of grandparent and this sort of blue blood from New England that traced ancestry to a pair of brothers that fought in the Civil War, and they all sort of come from Barbary pirates or something like that. And so what I'd like to know is, can we take a sample from, you know, this little boy and reconstruct the, where, you know, all these sort of bits of the genealogy. And it may seem...
It's worth getting, there's a wonderful Mad Magazine takeoff on.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, that picture, which has, I don't know, like the Polish evolving from toaster.
Right, right. Where did Alfred E. Newman come from? And again, so one aspect, of, one way to do this is a spatial prediction. I'm actually not going to talk about this because John's going to talk about it. I'm going to talk about a sort of separate approach, which relates to your question about the Mexican admixture, which is that these principal components themselves are quite good proxies for ancestry, right? So if we think about a given African-American, for example, here, the linear distance from the Yoruban centroid versus the European centroid may be a good proxy for what proportion of that individual's genome comes from one population or the other. And Kasia Brick, who's a fantastic graduate student in my lab, and I have a project with Sarah Tishkoff that sort of focuses on how, you know, trying to take this kind of approach. One very nice advantage about this is that this doesn't rely on a predefined population genetic model. It relies on the principal components that you've estimated. It also, if you have multiple principal components that may be important, you can generalize it to several approaches and several dimensions. And so one way to think about it is that there are going to be lots of, for example, for differentiating African and non-African, there's many, many, many markers in the genome that are going to be informative about this kind of information. And so if we take a sliding window, so we can think about this from the most basic point, this is how Kasia started to think about it. So let's take and look at all the individuals in your data set that are, say, African, and average out their PC1 score along the genome. And that would be blue. Now take all the individuals that are European and average out their PC1 scores, and that's the red line here. Now take a single individual, a single African American, and average out in a sliding window their PCA. So what is this is suggesting is that this individual has one European chromosome and one African chromosome, right? All along the genome. So mom was African, dad was European, or the other way around. Now here's a second individual. Again, here, this individual probably has one European and one African chromosome, but now it switches to having two African chromosomes, right? So this is very similar to the kind of deconstruction that, or reconstruction, deconstruction, we could get a whole debate, postmodern debate about what it is that structure is doing, a sort of estimation of ancestry along the genome. The nice thing about this is that it's incredibly fast and generalizable to multiple dimensions. What Kasia's done is overlay on this hidden Markov model, which we'll get to in a moment. The same thing applies to Mexicans. So here's an individual. We have, here's our European principal component, in blue our Amerindian, or, you know, we're principal component, and what you're seeing here is that this individual is mostly Amerindian. This individual is sort of typical. It's got 1 and 1 or 2 and 1, and so we can think about this as a state problem, right? We want to cycle between you have a total count of 2 chromosomes, and they can be in states 2, 0, 1, 1, or 0, 2. And so you sort of want to estimate your location in those states based on some transition probability, some model. So we basically run African Americans on the PCA. We've now included a diverse set of ancestral African populations. For each individual, we have, say, a 15 SNP window, which we can calculate by looking at the normalized genotype for the markers and the vector of loadings. We then overlay on top of that a hidden Markov model that allows us to figure out transitions. This is just sort of very kind of bread and butter hidden Markov models for these kinds of problems. The one thing we probably need to fudge a little bit is this probability of transitioning, and that probability of transitioning actually depends on whether the individual is has very recent common ancestry between African and Europeans or very ancient common ancestry. That'll determine the track lengths, but there's some of that you can actually estimate from the data. And so here's an application. Again, here's an individual that's just switching between 201102 and so on along the genome. When we overlay our hidden Markov model, we now get predictions about, well, here's the breakpoint for what this might look like. Okay, and we can take these and now make these sort of beautiful pictograms of the individuals in our data set. So there's about 500 African Americans in our data set. It takes about 5 minutes to do this reconstruction, which is really stunning in comparison to how long it takes to run structure. And here you're doing it with all the markers. You can generalize this to any populations you want. We are hoping to generalize it to doing multiple ancestry, so not just two principal components, but three, four, five principal components, then you're bouncing off of edges in a sort of hypercube. So here's an example. Here's a typical individual. Here's a track of African ancestry. Here's a track of European ancestry. Here's a heterozygote. Heterozygous for European African ancestry. So these are two typical individuals. Here's an individual that probably has one European parent because they've got mostly mostly heterozygous for Europe or have two European chromosomes. Yeah.
Does this mean that the scale at which you have captured recombination on this chip is sufficient to describe ancestry? Because that's the other assumption, right? That there's no recombination happening at a scale which is...
No, these are recombinations in the along the person's family tree. So this is a recombination.
Yeah, but you have one SNP every 1,000 bases approximately, or 2,000 bases, right?
But there's only one recombination per generation. And if you're talking about four or five generations, then you expect two, three recombinations per chromosome. You have a huge abundance of mark. You may not get the breakpoint exactly right, but you'll get that there's a recombination here or not a recombination.
No, I'm saying that your data supports that.
Yeah.
Because what you have shown by the consistency of what you just did is that it is sufficient to capture the every 1,000 mutations.
Exactly. Here's an individual that's described as African American and basically looks all European. So
apparently, we're going to have to vacate this room at 12.
Okay, we're done. We're basically done. So we've generalized this to different African populations, and here, for those of you who are kind of interested, we can actually compare the estimated... Here, so if I take Africa and African Americans, they've got an FST of about 0.7%. If I take Africa versus African American in the African-only regions of the genome, we estimate it's about 0.1%, which means we're really getting those African tracks probably quite right. It's about 13% for the regions we estimate to be European only. If we compare Europe and Africa, it's about 12%. So these numbers are all quite consistent. Here's Europe versus the African Americans, again, for the regions that are just African. So these numbers should all be comparable, and these numbers should all be comparable. So we're quite excited about this. We think it's quite cool, and we're hoping that we can now estimate what particular African populations are involved. This is a problem that to the African American community is of tremendous interest because they've lost this amount of information and huge amounts of information in the African diaspora. And so this is actually quite an important problem. So just to summarize, new technologies provide fine-scale genome-wide views of population structure and admixture. Important to realize that these SNP-chip results are reinforcing our prevailing view since the 70s that human population structure is largely spatial or clinal. We need to embrace admixture and challenges for genome-wide association mapping, and that this personal ancestry reconstruction is feasible on a genome-wide scale. With that, I'd like to thank first all of our monkey friends. I have the pleasure of having just about the world's greatest collaborators that collect all kinds of data, play around with it, and you know, there's absolutely no way we could even do this in a single lab, much less just my own lab. So I'm just, you know, incredibly privileged to be the spokesman for these projects. And then these are all the people that were involved in the GSK. And really, to single out my partner in crime, Captain November, that's not even listening, and I rap him on the head. But he's been a tremendous pleasure to work with him. And thank you. Handle any questions.